whose node is in the nucleus, which is why you can't easily drag an electron into a nucleus. You would think that because an electron is negatively charged and a nucleus is positively charged, it would be like astrophysics. It would circle around and decay and finally be captured by the nucleus. And if that actually happened, then we wouldn't have life or anything else. Everything would just be a bunch of neutrons. But it isn't. And the reason why, again, is because of the wave equation nature of particles. So I agree with you that the positrons are particles. They are not energy waves, per se, but you can...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Can you repeat from I agree with you?
I wish I had these answers written down as well as these stories, because I could just look at my place. But ultimately, and I don't know what's going on with the timer these days. But anyway, I agree with you that a positron is a particle and not a wave like electromagnetism. But particles do obey quantum mechanical rules, and the probabilities of what happens to them can be described very accurately in wave equations, which used to be used primarily for things like electromagnetic waves. The probability of a wave function of an electron or a photon or such, if you square it, it gives you the probability of where that might be. And in some cases, the probability of an electron existing close to the nucleus approaches zero, which is why of electron as wave function.
You said particles obey duality. In physical science, a particle is a small localized object to which can be described several physical or chemical properties that would be volume, density, or mass. So the size or quantity from subatomic particles, like electron or microscopic particles, could determine a factor of particle acting as in duality equation. The question is, how big is the particle?
Ultimately, according to quantum mechanics, everything has an inherent wave function. You have a wave function, I have a wave function. Because of our incredibly large mass and momentum, our wave function is infinitesimally small and doesn't play any part. For some atomic particles, their wave function is considerably more important. Now, you mentioned something as an aside, and the problem is that you said something about size. Particles have size. Particles have density. Most particles have size and have density. Unfortunately, again, in quantum mechanics, elemental particles don't. Electrons do not have a well-known diameter. You can look up the diameter of an electron. What they will tell you is it's less than, and they'll give a value of the lab equipment's limits of measuring. So they can't tell you it's zero, but they can't tell you what it is. They just say it's less than my lab equipment will show. And because there's a big question about what the heck is the size of an electron, you can't make sense of the concept of what's the density of an electron. If an electron actually has a point singularity, a dimensionlessness, it has an infinite density. So although most particles, I agree with you, do have density and volume and dimensions, fundamental particles unfortunately don't, or at least people think they don't.
Electron is the standard model. Quarks and electrons are some of very elementary particles. We have a positron that is the antiparticle of the electron. We have a beta particle, and beta particles are high energy, high speed electrons or positrons. Electron cloud then is everything together of given species. The question is, what would happen with subatomic particles like quarks or smaller, or not really smaller, or sub-elementary particles in terms of duality?
See, I hate to fall into semantics, but the concept of an elemental, a fundamental object is that there is no sub-fundamental part of it. The thing that makes it a truly fundamental thing, like an electron, is if you dive down into the electron, there is no finer structure that it's a pair of Clevelands or whatever you want to make believe. That was what went on with the neutron and the proton. There were a lot of indications that it was a very complicated structure, in that neutrons should be have no magnetic dipoles because they are chargeless, and yet neutrons do have a magnetic dipole. It's a weak one, but they have one. And the reason why they have one is because they're made of three things that all have a charge in and of themselves. They add up to zero, but inside it's more complex than that. So the big difference is fundamental particles have no subparticles. Fundamental is the lowest, it's the bottom turtle. You know, the old story about Carl Sagan, that some lady told him that the universe is just a turtle with the Earth on its back, and he asked, what was the turtle standing on? And she said, another turtle. Basically, it's turtles all the way down.
There is a difference in energy. You or other particles, let's say electron neutrino, we may say that mass of electron neutrino is less than 2.2 electron volts, and the mass of muon neutrino is less of, let's say, 117 kilo electron volts. Depends which one we take. It's not exactly said. But what I'm saying is, since we have a difference of energy and we could somehow relate it to mass, then we cannot put everything into the one bucket and say, hey, all of them should react as one in terms of duality. Am I right or wrong?
Well, yeah, I mean, just because they're point singularities does not determine their mass or their angular momentum or a whole bunch of other things. So those are quantum numbers that define specific subatomic particles. There's a range of allowable quantum numbers that each type of particle can sustain. And different particles have different masses, and you know, I mean, that's just the nature of things. There's a very nice table all over the place. If you look up standard model of quantum mechanics, pictures, representations, if you will, of the different types of quarks, the different types of leptons, electrons, tau, and muons, and their neutrinos and antineutrinos, and they all have different rest masses.
No, I was talking about the interaction. So let's say electron neutrino is created along with the lepton electron, and in the other hand, muon neutrino is created with the lepton muon. So if we try to go from the point of view of interaction and energy level, and now try to find the differences, do you know what I'm talking about?
Well, again, it depends. Electrons are much smaller I found the thing of smaller. It's not smaller. It's lighter. It has less mass. Taus have a lot more mass. They have a lot more energy. They are a lot less stable. They tend to decay into lighter mass particles, fundamental type of particles. As far as neutrinos, unfortunately, they complicate things, because you would sort of think that electrons produce electron neutrinos, and muons produce muon neutrinos, and taus produce tau neutrinos. But the problem is that neutrinos actually change flavor as they race. the electron neutrinos produced by the fusion of the sun itself, when it reaches us, we detect not as many electron neutrinos as we would theoretically calculate. And the reason that we finally figured it out is we then tested to see if we were getting a stream of other types of neutrinos. And from the sun to the Earth will oscillate between states of being a tau neutrino and a muon neutrino.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wes. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yes. I was always thought that the electron was 1,800 times lighter than the proton. But somewhere, you know, like about, I don't know, in the beginning of this, more or less, you said that the electron mass can't be measured. Should I throw that out of my mind now? No, it was always 1,800 to 1 proton to electron. Is that still a standard?
Yeah, it still counts. I'm sorry if I confuse things. It's not that the mass that out of the equation. Different fundamental particles have different rest masses, and so electrons are much lighter than a neutron or a proton. And it leads to some complications, because if you add up the weight of the three quarks that make up the proton or the neutron, it makes no sense of the rest mass differences. Neutrons and protons, if you only took account of the subatomic quarks that make them up, would be a lot less massive. Even if you take the energy of the gluons that are sticking, making them stick together, it doesn't provide enough energy. You have to do some real quantum mechanical magic in which you have a theoretical virtual quark gluon clouds surrounding all the present quarks and gluons, and all those virtual particles add mass to a proton or a neutron. But as I said before, masses are well known. No problem with masses. It's the size of things like electrons and quarks that we have great problems with.
Okay, very good. I just don't want to lose that one solid piece of concrete information. You know, the proton and the neutron were always equal in mass, and then the electron was 1,800 to 1. After that, well, you know, you're talking about taus and everything else, the gluons. I guess you're saying when they figure out the mass of that stuff, it doesn't add up. Well, maybe there's more missing parts. You know how they found the leptons and all these other things. Maybe there's some other missing parts they don't know about. Back to you, Roy.
I have a question.
Well, I don't know. They seem to really like this virtual gluon quark cloud rationale for why it's more massive. It gets kind of rather woolly. What can I tell you? You know, there are two up quarks and a down quark gives you a proton, two down quarks and an up quark gives you a neutron. They're about the same mass. They're not identical, but they're very close to each other. So, Wesley, what do you want to say?
One of young students asked me the question, do protons move in energy levels? And since proton has the same positive charge as the electron, negative, despite all of the variations of it and the size. When electron jump from K to L, let's say, or L to M, what would happen with charge of the proton? So I thought this is an interesting question to ask.
Well, it's an interesting question. It's a question that probably even theoretical physicists would have a lot of problems with. Is it possible that there is some equivalent nuclear version of energy levels the way that valence electrons have? Perhaps, but we don't really know that much. It's so small and so difficult to measure the things that we don't really have a clue. We know of some interactions that protons and neutrons have in the nucleus. They will change their spins, and that's the reason why nuclear magnetic resonance imaging actually works. But as far as energy levels within the nucleus, I don't even think the Wollier theories really address that. Most of the energy level phenomena is going on in the valence electrons because of the lack of such an incredibly strong force that the gluons hold. The gluons are the carriers of the strong nuclear force, which is an incredibly strong force. It's something like 10 to the 50th times the strength of gravity. And that holds the nucleus together. So it limits the amount of juggling and changing levels. Electrons don't have that type of problem, so they can jump to higher energy states as you could think of it in waves like harmonic levels. But the nucleus probably does not.
And the last very simple question, what is the name for the amount of energy needed to move from one energy level to the other?
Well, yeah, there's no specific name for it. It's just energy. You can give the electron volt equivalent for it. You could give the fractional joule amount to it. Energy units are inherently convertible because they're discussing the same fundamental thing. It's just the magnitude of the selected unit. So most of the times people discuss them in electron volts, but you can discuss them in other forms. You could discuss them in horsepower if you're so inclined.
You take electron volts, you're talking about units and quantity of units. Talking about energy, it is quantum energy. Do you agree with that?
I'm addressing it as the unit of energy. Again, quantum energy, mechanical energy, kinetic energy, gravitational energy, electromagnetic energy, ultimately they're convertible into each other, and so they're just different views of the same thing from a slightly different angle.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, Wesley. Any other questions, or we'll move on to, I think is an interesting little story that I found. Okay, I tend to burst conspiracy theories here. So here's a declassified secret operation from our lovely government that shows that some secrets can actually be kept secret until they're not. In a corner exhibit of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., which opened just this weekend, a submarine control panel, a swoopy banged wig, a detailed white print, and a chunk of manganese are on display. Together, they represent relics of Cold War espionage missions so audacious. The museum's curator, Vince Horton, compares it to a heist from the movie Ocean's 11. Azorian involved the CIA commissioning and constructing a 600-foot ship to retrieve a sunken Soviet submarine from the ocean floor, all in complete secrecy. He said, I can't imagine there's another country in the world that would have thought this. We found a Soviet submarine under 3 miles of water, so let's go steal it, said Horton. Anyway, the six-year mission began in 1968 when the Soviet ballistic missile submarine K-129 went missing without explanation somewhere in the Pacific Ocean. In this post-Cuban missile crisis era, both American and Soviet submarines prowled the open seas with nuclear weapons aboard, prepared for potential war. Some reports indicated that the sinking was due to a mechanical error, such as an inadvertent missile engine ignition, while the Soviets for a time suspected the Americans of foul play. After 2 months, the Soviet Union abandoned its search for K-129 and the nuclear weapons it carried. But the United States, which had recently used Air Force technology to locate two of its own sunken submarines, pinpointed K-129 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii and 16,500 feet below the surface. According to the declassified CIA history of the project, no country in the world has succeeded.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Can I either have to talk faster or break way more times? Anyway, let me just roll this up a little bit. Let's see. After 2 months, the Soviet Union abandoned its search for K-129 and the nuclear weapons it carried, but the United States, which had recently used Air Force technology to locate two of its own sunken submarines, pinpointed the K-129 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii and 16,500 feet below the surface, according to declassified CIA history of the project. No country in the world had succeeded in raising an object of this size and weight from such a depth. Let me drop. Internally, the intelligence community deliberated about the cost-to-reward ratio of such an expensive and risky undertaking, even as the submarine offered a tantalizing trove of information. According to Horton, the value of the K-129 stemmed not just from the code books and the nuclear warheads on board, but also the chance to understand the manufacturing process behind the rival powers' submarines. If the U.S. knew how the K-129's sonar system operated or the mechanism by which the submarines kept quiet, they could improve their ability to detect them, was the idea. And by 1967, the Soviet Union had amassed an armament of nuclear weapons large enough that the two nations had virtual nuclear parity. As a result, the Americans were hungry to gain a competitive advantage. An edge on the K-129 might provide that. The CIA brainstormed several improbable-sounding means of recovering the submarine. One suggestion involved generating enough gas on the ocean floor to buoy the submarine to the surface. Instead, they settled on an idea reminiscent of the classic arcade game, a giant claw, and would grasp and pull the K-129 into the moon pool belly of a giant ship. Initially, the project boasted an estimated 10% chance of success. Let me drop for a sec. Legally speaking, the U.S. Was concerned that the project could leave them open to charges of piracy if the Soviets had an inkling of the illicit submarine salvaging plans. Wanting to sidestep diplomatic tensions and keep whatever knowledge was to be gleaned from the mission's secrets, the CIA constructed an elaborate cover story with the help of enigmatic billionaire Howard Hughes. The aviation mogul lent his imprimatur to the construction of a 618-foot-long ship to be named the Hughes Glomar Explorer, which was advertised as a deep-sea mining research vessel. In 1972, a champagne christening ceremony and fabricated press release celebrated the ship. When the ship first sailed from Pennsylvania to the waters near Bermuda for testing in 1973, the Los Angeles Times noted the occasion, calling the vessel shrouded in secrecy, and observing newsmen were not permitted to view the launches in detail, and details of the ship's destination and mission were not released. Evidently, the public and press chalked the mystery up to Hughes' reputation as a recluse, such a loner that he was said to eschew even his own company's board meeting. Let me drop for a sec. Next, the Glomar Explorer navigated to the Pacific around South America because it was too wide to pass through the Panama Canal. After some minor foibles, the U.S.-assisted 1973 Chilean coup happened the same day as seven technicians were trying to board the ship in the country's port city of Valparaiso. The Glomar Explorer arrived in Long Beach, California, where it loaded more than 20 vans full of equipment, including a darkroom, paper processing, nuclear waste handling, and for analyzing the K-129's contents. Meanwhile, a team built the claw nicknamed Clementine and formerly known as the capture vehicle in a gargantuan floating barge called HB-1 in Redwood City. In the spring of 1974, HMB-1 submerged and met up with the Glomar Explorer off the coast of Catalina Island in Southern California. HMB-1 opened its roof, and the Glomar Explorer opened the bottom of its hollow moon pool to take the steel claw on board. The HMB-1 detached and returned to the Redwood City, and the transfer being completely unnoticed. That summer, the Glomar Explorer, with the approval of President Richard Nixon, set off towards the spot where K-129 rested. By this time, the Cold War had reached a detente, but still two separate Soviet ships, likely loaded with intelligence operatives, closely monitored the supposed mining vessels as it worked to retrieve the submarine. At one point, the Glomar crew members even piled crates on their landing deck to prevent an attempt to land a helicopter. But the mission continued undetected as the 274 pieces of heavy steel pipe that stretched between the floor and the ship were being slowly hauled back on board with the submarine in Clementine's...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
We got away with it. The Soviet tug sailed away. After a week of slow upward progress, Project Azorian finally completed the lift of K-129, but only one part of it. According to Project Azorian, the CIA and the raising of K-129, a book co-written by naval historian Norma Palmer and documentary director Michael White, about midway through the process, a few of the grabber knobs encircling the submarine broke, and a large part of K-129 fell back into the ocean floor. While the latter media reports and history books generally relayed that the more desirable components of the submarine, like the code room, sunk, Houghton encourages skepticism of the details surrounding the project's ostensible failure. The conventional wisdom, he said, has become that this was a failed mission. He explained the CIA has allowed sources from the CIA declassified documents and recently published historical accounts, but since the other findings from the mission are still classified, and the CIA may have had reasons to obfuscate the story, skepticism remains warranted. Let me drop for a sec. We do know, however, that the Glomar Explorer retrieved the bodies of several of the K-129's crew members, whom they gave a military burial at sea, which the CIA filmed and gave to Russia almost 20 years later. Coincidentally, the retrieval also brought up manganese samples from the bottom of the sea, the material that the Glomar Explorer purportedly was researching. The U.S. seems to have gotten away with the elaborate submarine heist. Ford Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger said in the White House meeting, the operation is a marvel in early 1975. However, after a random robbery of the headquarters of Hughes Suma Corporation, which was acting as the front for the Glomar Explorer, the story made its way to the headlines of the Los Angeles Times and national television. The story broke later than it could have. The famed New York Times reporter Seymour Hersh had been following it as early as 1973, but honored a request from the CIA director, William Colby, to suppress the story, and was riddled with inaccuracies. The code name was thought to be Jennifer, which was actually referred only to its security procedures, and the LA Times report placed the recovery effort in the Atlantic Ocean. Nevertheless, it was enough to alert the Soviet Union and disturb President Ford. Project Matador, the plan to retrieve the rest of K-129, apparently got nixed as news of the thought-to-have-failed mission and its rumors, plus the $300 million price tag, was circulated. Let me drop. Okay, the CIA also faced a diplomatic dilemma that spring, pressed by the Soviet ambassador to the U.S. and Freedom of Information Act request from journalists. They wanted to avoid directly acknowledging that they had illicitly stolen a submarine from the watchful Soviets, but were obligated to somehow respond. The U.S. government did not want to embarrass the Soviets, Houghton said, mainly because in doing so, they really set diplomacy back significantly, because the Soviet premier would have had to respond through sanctions or an attack on a territory. In the effort to walk this diplomatic tightrope and comply with the Freedom of Information Act requirements, the Glomar response was, "We can neither confirm nor deny," was coined. While Glomar response stood up in federal court as a reason to deny the Freedom of Information Act request, the incident, writes historian M. Todd Bennett, intensified otherwise routine intelligence wars, tit-for-tat actions taken by the Soviet and American intelligence service. That May, Soviet operatives increased the amount of microwave radiation trained on the American embassy in Moscow. Let me drop. 45 years after the Glomar Explorer hauled part of the K-129 from the ocean floor, Project Azorian remains a legendary within the intelligence community. The glass cases showing the onesies worn by crew members on board, phony belt buckles, safety awards, and barometers from the ship, and even a wig CIA director, Deputy Director Vernon Walters, wore to pay the Glomar Explorer an incognito visit. But they also name-check engineer John Graham and display a scaled-down version of the detailed white print used to design the now-defunct ship. Azorian stands out because it was so bold, so ambitious, and it almost was guaranteed to fail. And yet, although only part of the submarine was retrieved, the ship was built, and the almost ridiculous proposition of a giant claw extending to the ocean floor proved functional. And despite the scale of the project, it stayed secret for 7 years. This fine museum positions the Azorian saga as a paean to innovation, an exemplar of how the unsolvable problems of the intelligence world can be tackled with creativity and technological advances. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Which part of the ship was raised up? Was that also including nuclear weapons? What is in the report that is released to the public?
Pretty much nothing. The suggestion generally had been in the past that I don't even know if they were specific about which part broke which, but they led. They gave the impression, which the guys at the museum doubt, that the nuclear weapons fell back into the bottom of the sea there. I don't think we can rely on the declassified information from the CIA, and I leave it up to your imagination how much they actually picked up that time.
Thank you very much.
Okay, on to the next. One quick reminder before we dive into this very next story. As I've said repeatedly, and I will probably say repeatedly in the future, correlation does not always prove causation. In other words, just because most people who die have slept in a bed-like structure within the previous 24 hours does not mean that sleeping in a bed causes premature death. With that in mind, new research has found a perplexing, though relatively small, link between the devastating neurological illness of Parkinson's disease and having your appendix removed. But it's still unclear just what exactly that could mean, and it's definitely not a reason to avoid an appendectomy if you actually need one. Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disorder that currently afflicts around 1 million Americans. At first, the movement disorder causes mild tremors that can go completely unnoticed. But over time, people lose their ability to walk, talk, eat, and eat without difficulty. In the later stages, even the mind can be affected, leading to dementia. Though there are medications and treatments like deep brain stimulation that can help people manage the symptoms, and the disorder itself isn't fatal, people with Parkinson's still die sooner than the general population, often due to complications related to the disease. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, we know the protein alpha-synuclein is intimately connected to Parkinson's, since toxic clumps of that protein, called Lewy bodies, are abundantly seen in the brains of sufferers. This misfolded alpha-syn is thought to help destroy the neurons responsible for producing dopamine. But while some cases of Parkinson's are directly tied to inherited mutations of this alpha-syn, we still don't know why the majority of these cases happen. Now, some research, however, has shown that the abnormal protein isn't just found in the brains of people with Parkinson's, but is also in their gut as well. That led to a theory that the gut, already known to affect the brain and vice versa, could play a crucial role in the disease's development. The appendix comes into the picture because despite its reputation as a useless vestigial organ, it probably still does something useful, if not essential, in our body. So there's a connection between losing your appendix, as many people do when their infected organ is surgically removed, and Parkinson's disease. That's evidence that the gut as a whole is causally linked to the disease. Now, last October, researchers studied population data from more than 1 million Swedish residents and found that people who had their appendix removed were slightly less likely to develop Parkinson's, but other research has shown that there was no clear link between the two events. Let me drop for a sec. So Gregory Cooper and his team at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio decided to look with an even bigger microscope. They studied the electronic health records of more than 62 million Americans. Contrary to the October study, though, they spotted an increased risk of Parkinson's among those who had their appendix removed, roughly three times higher. And while Parkinson's starts becoming much more common in old age, a consistent added risk from appendix removal was even seen in those who developed it younger and across different ethnicities. This is the largest study to date that looked at this, and it's believed to be the most generalized to the overall population. But before anyone panics, none of this means that people shouldn't get their appendectomies if they need them. Even with that threefold risk, it was still less than 1% of individuals who had appendectomies and went on to develop Parkinson's. So in the grand scheme of things, it's a very low risk, and it shouldn't dissuade anyone from getting an appendectomy. Let me drop for a second. And even in the case that losing your appendix really does cause a greater risk of Parkinson's, he added, it probably still wouldn't be worth foregoing the surgery given the immediate life-threatening risk of an infected appendix. Regardless, the study does offer more circumstantial evidence that the gut is somehow involved in Parkinson's disease, whether through alpha-syn or something completely different. The team's findings were presented this past week at the annual research conference, Digestive Disease Week. These results are preliminary, and researchers said they plan to submit their research to a peer-reviewed journal. Future studies could involve more closely studying the medical charts of people who have lost their appendix in order to rule out other factors that could explain both a person's likelihood of appendectomy and Parkinson's disease. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie dokie, here's one on a very interesting science known as linguistics. If you've ever investigated the fascinating field of linguistics, you might have discovered that the overwhelming majority of Europeans, people of the Indian subcontinent and Iran, ancient Persia, appear to have evolved from common ancient language. The linguists call this a Proto-Indo-European. The only seeming exception to this common language origin appears to be among Hungarians, Finns, and Estonians. Northern Europeans who speak Uralic languages, such as Estonians and Finnish, can thank ancient migrating Siberian populations for their dialect, according to a fascinating new study that combined genetics, archaeology, and linguistics. The majority of Europeans can trace their origin back to several ancestral populations, namely indigenous European hunter-gatherers, early farmers from the Anatolians, now known as Turkey, and Eurasian steppe herders. European speakers of the Uralic languages, such as Estonian and Finns, have a DNA from ancient Siberians, which is unique among European populations. The commingling of migrating Siberians with northern Europeans likely happened at some point within the last 5,000 years, but scientists have struggled to put a more precise date on it. Let me drop for a sec. A research team led by archaeogeneticist, that's a new one, Leti Saad from the University of Tartu in Estonia, has published new research in the journal Current Biology that seems to finally answer this unresolved question. By combining genetics with archaeology and linguistics, the team has shown that the Uralic language speakers reached the Baltic at the beginning of the Iron Age, some 2,500 years ago. What's more, the migrating Siberians brought more than just their language with them. They also brought their DNA, the traces of which can still be seen in northern European populations. For the study, Sag and her colleagues extracted ancient DNA from the teeth of 56 individuals who lived between 3,200 to 4,000 years ago, of which 43 provided samples robust enough for a DNA analysis. The remains were pulled from the Estonian Late Bronze Age graves dating to about 1200 to 400 BC and pre-Roman Iron Age graves dating back to between 800 BC and 50 BC. Let me drop for a second. Studying ancient DNA makes it possible to pinpoint the moment in time when the genetic components that we see in modern populations reach the area, since instead of predicting past events based on modern genomes, they're analyzing the DNA of individuals who actually lived in a particular time in the past, explained Saag in a press release. Results of the analysis showed that Siberians reached the eastern Baltic no later than 2,500 years ago. We show that a component of possibly Siberian ancestry was added to the gene pool of the Eastern Baltic during the Bronze to Iron Age transition of, at the latest, wrote the authors of the study. Notably, the Bronze to Iron Age transition period also coincided with the hypothesized arrival of westernmost Uralic Finnic languages in Eastern Baltic, supporting the idea that the spread of these languages were mediated by migrants from the East.
Also, comment by KD2PDF when I get a chance back to that.
Okay, we'll be done soon. Northern Europeans who speak a Uralic language, such as Estonians and Finnish, can thank ancient migrating Siberian populations for their dialect, according to a fascinating new study that combined genetics, archaeology, and linguistics. Anyway, intriguingly, consistent with other research, analysis found that migrating Siberians introduced the genetic variants for light eye, hair, and skin, along with an intolerance of lactose, characteristics that are still present in modern Northern Europeans. These traits can now be traced all the way back to the Bronze Age in the East Baltic. As the authors noted in the study, the findings are in line with previous suggestions that light skin pigmentation alleles reached high frequency in Europe only recently. Looking ahead, SOG would like to study Iron Age migration in more detail and conduct genetic analysis of individuals living during the medieval time period. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GF.
Hey, AC2GS, KD2PPF. Yeah, I actually did the 23andMe, found a lot of good things. I found out I've got a lot of Indian in me, which is weird because I always thought I was a cowboy. But, yeah, very good subject, and thanks for bringing that up. KD2PPF listening and having fun.
Well, very good. That's the whole point of this exercise. Yes, thankfully, the price of these home genetic kits have gone down in price. They're not written in stone, unfortunately. They're a work in progress, and as they get more data from more people and more information from those people, the results get better and better. There's a significant amount of variation in the results, unfortunately, because at best, it doesn't inherently tell people what ethnic group per se you come from, but more the geographic location of the genetic traits that they test for. So you get a better feel for a geographic location than an inherent ethnic racial group. But they are fascinating. I've had loads of people who've done that test, and it's certainly an entertaining thing. And I'm glad you were entertained by that little story.
Hey, Roger, KD2PPF. One of the main things that I really was happy about, but I found out that was related to Alexander Hamilton, which running on Broadway right now, so that was kind of funny. KD2PPF, back to net, and thank you. I'm just listening.
Okay, very good. It's nice to be related to famous people. I think they did some kind of genetic research and decided that guys like Genghis Khan have something like 20 or 30 million descendants out there. Be fruitful and multiply, I guess, was the rule. I've heard some very fascinating stories of people who've gone for the genetic research, and they have found brothers and sisters that they had no knowledge of, because there are, when you file some of your genetic material, sometimes they say that if you would like to be contacted by other people with similar genetic results. So there are these intriguing stories of people who were separated in infancy, who didn't know, you know, in one case I think they were twins, but in other cases they were just siblings, and they found each other. So it's a fascinating subject again, is a work in progress and will get better. And there's political and economic problems with it as well, in that law enforcement agencies would like to borrow the genetic material so that they might not be able to find an actual perpetrator, but they might find a close relative of the perpetrator and trace the genetics back to them. So there's all kinds of interesting issues politically and legally. So it's a fascinating subject. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Anyway, we're coming up to almost 11 o'clock, so probably I should give some room for Paul and just remind people, if you have any topics that you want or questions that you want or reputations, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, did it again. Very quickly. Email, you need to get to me. You want to ask me a question or make a comment or whatever, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. You want to read further on the material, there will be links available in 10 minutes on roy.ac2gs.com. So, as always, thanks to all the people that participated, thanks to Paul, and thanks to Dick. And I will hand it over to Dick so he can hand it over to Paul and give us the space report.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. Good stuff. I was tempted to break in and explain where an antenna pattern comes from. Every antenna, except for an isotropic antenna, has an antenna pattern. In other words, there's some direction where it directs most of the signal, and other directions where it directs a little bit of the signal, like side lobes and nulls and so on. Where does that antenna pattern come from? What happens inside the antenna to do that? I was tempted to break in and explain it from my point of view. Very few people have got a good explanation for where the antenna pattern comes from, in general, on any antenna. I may go into that next week. Okay, Paul, one of the things that was very exciting to me about what happened in the last week was the Blue Moon. The lander by, I think it's the, it's not the Amazon, is it the Amazon people? Yes. But this Blue Moon is really a much larger lunar excursion module. And in the articles, when you go there, you see I'm talking about going back to the moon with this new, larger lunar lander and staying there for a while, which, as you and I know, is kind of naive. You can't stay there for very long. However, let me drop it. When you go to those Blue Moon selected YouTube videos, you'll find a number of adjacent videos, and one of them shows you all the places where the six landings of Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17, where did they land on the moon, and what was the phase of the moon at that time? When you go to that particular video, which is really a graphic video, you'll realize that every one of the landings was at a sunrise position on the moon. Not sunset, sunrise. So as the sun was rising, that's the spot on the moon where they landed all of those six times, all 12 of those astronauts. And that's because of the temperature problem. The midway between the super cold at night and the super hot during the day. And they could only stay there for at most a couple of days before going from too cold to too hot. So, and it's also another view of the extreme deep field picture. That extreme deep field picture, the latest version of it, is also one of the YouTube videos, which consists of 2 million pictures integrated together on top of each other. 2 million seconds worth of total exposure to make those pictures. And those pictures are something like 30 million or 30 billion times more sensitive than the human eye. 27 orders of magnitude, optical orders of magnitude, dimmer than what a human eye can see, which is around 6. So therefore, it was 33 orders of magnitude was the weakest thing that you can see. And when you look at that picture, you see 5,500 things on that picture. Every one of those dots, 5,500 of them, is a complete galaxy. Fascinating, amazing stuff. WS2S, go right ahead, Paul. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick, and thanks, Roy. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And like Roy said about questions, if you want to email me, too, you could email me at spacenetreport@gmail.com. But mostly everything goes over to Roy and to his mailbag or whatever, and then he will he will bring the questions up to Dick if they're technical questions or for me for the space questions. And okay, on that, those pictures, Dick, all the stars. I believe that was from the Hubble. And now, if we could ever get W first up there, the next infrared telescope that's going to orbit the Earth, not James Webb, but W first, that would be the same quality as Hubble, but except the 100 times the field of view than Hubble. So that would really be something. Let me drop it. And I was going to talk about the Blue Moon project later, but you know that's definitely a move that Jeff Bezos has wanted to do for a long time. He's been building this Blue Moon lander with the new B-7 engine for about 3 years now. So when White House decided to push things up a bit, going from 2028 to 2024, these people are all happy about it, but and NASA's not going to really put that much more money into it, so it will be up to private companies like Blue Origin and SpaceX to assist in that endeavor. We'll have to wait and see how far they get. Right now, they got a long way to go for landing people on the moon before 2024. A lot of things have to happen. Let me drop it. Okay, last week I talked about SpaceX launching another Falcon 9 up to the International Space Station with a Dragon on top. Dragon is the cargo vehicle, and this one had 5,500 pounds worth of stuff, science, equipment, clothes, and food for the astronauts. And that thing last week did dock to the space station. It docked to the bottom part of the space station, what they considered the nadir part of Harmony. They call it Birth. It comes in and gets close to the space station about 30, 50 feet away, and then this robotic arm reaches out from the space station, a 57-foot robotic arm. It grabs a hold of the spacecraft, and it guides it into its position, and then it's bolted up with 16 bolts. But now the space station now has 6 spacecraft attached to it. So they have 2 more ports left. So they have a total of 8 ports on the space station, and there's 6 vehicles right there attached at this moment. Let me drop it. They now have the Dragon vehicle. They have the Cygnus vehicle, which went up a couple of weeks ago. And they also have 2 Progress Russian cargo vehicles attached to the space station, as well as 2 crew space vehicles, Soyuz vehicles attached. The reason for that is you have 6 people on board and three seats in each spacecraft. So 6 ports are occupied right now by the space station. You have 2 more available, and they are docking ports. So you could fill one with a Boeing crew vehicle and another one with a Dragon crew vehicle, and that would complete all 8 ports on the space station. Let me just go over to what China is doing. China is trying to get involved with the private corporations inside of China. They're trying to, right now they're trying to get a satellite into orbit from a private company. So far there's been 2 companies, Landing Space Technology Corporation and One Space Technology. Both have failed, but now you have another one going to give it a shot in June. We'll have to find out if they make it. They think that they have a shot because there's more money involved with a company called iSpace. So iSpace is the name of the company. China, they're trying to duplicate what we do here. They're thinking about reusability. We'll have to see how they do. I'll give a report whether or not they make it in June. And Roy was talking about the DART mission. We'll move on to the DART mission. That's the double asteroid redirection test called DART. That will be 2022. It'll probably be launched in 2021. And the idea is to go to an asteroid called Didymos, and Didymos A, Didymos B. Didymos B is a little moon that goes around the main asteroid. The idea of this mission is to go out to see if you could deflect an asteroid. You know, in the future, we're going to need a way to do this in case one comes barreling by and it's on a direct path to Earth. We want to be able to find a way to move it. So they're going to test this one system of smashing into an asteroid. They're going to fly out there with DART, and they're going to shoot a projectile into this the moon of this, you know, this binary system. And and once they do that, they'll be able to look from Earth, and you could see the two asteroids. They look like pinpoints of light, but the way it's oriented, one passes in front of the other on a regular basis. And they want to see after they hit it with their projectile over time, if they want to be able to see if the occultation between the two, when one goes in front of the other, if it changes even a little bit, they know that they've done something. And the idea of it would be that now, you know, at a certain time, the two would be aligned differently to Earth. Therefore, it would be have a different gravitational pull than what it normally would have had, and therefore changing the course of these two asteroids. Well, that's the idea of the mission, but we'll have to see how that works out in 2022. But I thought one of the interesting, two interesting parts of the spacecraft DART. One, it's running a much stronger Hall effect, ion rocket. This one's a Hall effect ion rocket. They're supposed to be developing it where it's got this magnetic setup that's inside the, let's call it the engine, where the electrons and the protons that are shooting out of this thing do not come close to the wall because of this magnetic effect. With a standard ion engine, it could go on for years. But eventually, what happens is the protons, the ions, start hitting the inside of the thrust, I guess you would call it, the thrust tube, and it would start wearing it out. You know, because they're on, 24 hours a day, the force is so small, maybe the weight of a couple of pieces of paper in your hand, that's the force. But over time, it degrades the outer, the part of the exhaust of this rocket. With this system, they plan on having some kind of magnetic setup where that doesn't happen, where nothing could ever get near the walls. And based on that theory, you could actually have this thing work forever without ever wearing out. The one thing you do need is plenty of solar power to run these things, especially this one. This one takes up a little bit more energy. So they've developed a new type of solar panel, which is going to deliver a lot more energy, but it'll be also a lot lighter than the old system. It's called the ROSA, R-O-S-A. It stands for Roll Out Solar Array. So compared to the older ones, they could roll out a lot further. They're about, they're also like 400% lighter or something than the older ones. and it happened to be about 20% more efficient than the older system too. It's an interesting setup. And, you know, solar panels that they use now, they open up like an accordion. They have a bunch of hinges, and you know, when they expand, this accordion effect happens. You know, like you might have 4 or 8 panels on each side. But these are very heavy. This is a rollout system, like they call it, the rollout solar array. And they've actually tested this 2.